Get ready! TheEducationLawyers.com Sunday School Show.
You don't mind if I just sit in on your class this afternoon, do you?
With your host, Joseph Montgomery.
Noisy bunch, aren't they?
Yes, but if you stand there long enough, they'll usually quiet down. Don't try and shout over them.
And it begins in 5.
Never let somebody tell you
4.
You can't do something.
3.
You gotta protect
2.
It. You want something?
1.
Go get it.
Let's go! Go!
Good morning and welcome to another episode of the EducationLawyers.com Sunday School Show. We're broadcasting live from the 107.9 studios in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My name is Joseph Montgomery and I'm your host this and every Sunday. I'm a lawyer that has dedicated my practice to education and civil rights issues, but beyond that, I'm a person committed to lifelong learning. The Sunday School Show is built on and around education and learning. The Sunday School Show is an educational show, but that doesn't mean we're only talking about educational issues. It doesn't mean we're only talking about school and school-based issues. It means we are education. We're educating. We are the school, and we're here to learn. Today, we're talking and learning about happiness. Are you happy? Oh, no, that's a dreaded question, right? Sometimes it's better not to even think about it. It's like when someone asks you if you're cold. You weren't cold before, but now that it's in your head, you start to wonder a little bit. And a lot of people are wondering, right? Thousands and thousands of books are written each year with happiness in the title. Happiness is on people's minds. Are so many adults struggling with the concept of happiness because they weren't taught how to be happy as a child? Is happiness something that we can teach? Or is happiness already being taught? It's just maybe not so in your face. Maybe pure happiness, pure joy is something we're born with. Maybe we lose sight of bliss along the way and regain it later when we reflect on our own children and our grandchildren. As we do here on the Sunday School Show, we will be speaking with some of the leading experts on happiness from around the country. We'll be hearing from various perspectives, from analytical, psychological perspectives, as well as more intuitive, holistic, spiritual perspectives. If you're listening on the radio and you want to let us know what happiness means to you, please call, join in, join the discussion, 215-263-1079, 215-263-1079. Are you happy? Have you figured out how to teach happiness to your own children? Call, join in, 215-263-1079. If you'd rather participate remotely, you can live chat with us at educationlawyers.com/Sunday School. That's educationlawyers.com/Sunday School. You can also find today's show notes on educationlawyers.com/Sunday School. We're at Education Lawyers on Instagram. You can check out our live stream there. You can also see what's upcoming on the Sunday School Show. So today, I want to base this episode around that John Lennon quote, that John Lennon story. It goes like this. John Lennon said, "When I was 5 years old, my mother always told me that happiness was the key to life. When I went to school, they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wrote down happy. They told me I didn't understand the assignment, and I told them they didn't understand life." So that's a big quote right there. I want to tear it apart with our panel, and I want to start with Susan Shumsky. Susan, you're on the line?
Hello.
It's a pleasure to have you. Susan Shumsky is a spiritual teacher. She's the award-winning, best-selling author of 14 books published by Simon & Schuster, Touchtone, Random House, Celestial Arts, and others. She's a pioneer in the human potential field. She's taught meditation, affirmation, and intuition to thousands worldwide. She's been doing this for 50 years. She's been featured in GQ, Women's World, Cosmopolitan. The list goes on and on. Shumsky founded Divine Revelation. It's a technology for contacting the higher self and receiving, testing, and trusting clear intuition. For 22 years, her mentor was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the guru to the Beatles and Deepak Chopra. Shumsky served on Maharishi's personal staff for 6 years. So that's a pretty cool place to start, Susan. What was that like working with Maharishi?
Right. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, as I said, was the guru of the Beatles and guru of Deepak Chopra. And it was really amazing to be in his presence because he was the happiest person I've ever known or encountered.
What does that mean? What did it look like to see Maharishi so happy?
Well, he was continually cracking jokes. And when you were with him, you were also in stitches most of the time. And he exuded this charisma and this joyous presence, and he was spiritually awake. He was very peaceful, very content, and it was just a joy to be near him. And he exuded a powerful presence as well. You could feel this energy around him.
One thing I notice when I think of a happy person is kind of the way they deal with adversity. Can you think of an example? And then we're going to get to you, of course, but it just kind of got me thinking. Can you think of an example of a situation in the time that you were with him where things were just all falling apart and he just held it together and maintained composure and helped everyone get through it?
You know, he had a lot of attacks from the press, from reporters and that sort of thing. And they would be really mean and cruel to him all the time. But he just completely maintained his cool, maintained his composure in every situation. He was never flustered. He was always in command of every situation. And it really, I believe it has to do with his state of awareness, his higher consciousness that he had developed.
So how can we find this higher consciousness? How can we get to this state of awareness?
You know, I really loved that quote that you said from John Lennon. I had never heard that. And I wrote this book about the Beatles and Maharishi. And it's a wonderful quote. The reality is happiness is something that no one can have all the time. There's a lot of pressure on people to be happy all the time.
Right. And it's a question, you know, oh, are you happy? Does that make you? It's a question people ask where it's like, you know, how do you even respond? Like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm
happy.
Yeah,
really. I mean, you can't be happy all the time. It's impossible because happiness is a relative term. In other words, there's happiness and there's sadness, both. And you're going to experience both happiness and sadness throughout your life. However, there is something that you can experience all the time, and that is inner peace and contentment. And I truly believe that that is what John Lennon was talking about. He wasn't talking about, oh, happiness, you know. He was talking about the idea of experiencing who you really are, and the experience of who you really are brings contentment and brings inner peace.
Who you really are, does that mean just living your true purpose, your true course? What does that mean, who you really are? Is that like, maybe there's
exactly.
So if we go back to children and you're pushing a child in one direction or a certain career path and their heart is more in, you know, maybe a creative side or the arts, and you're pushing
exactly.
them towards like a more mathematical, or you want them to be a lawyer or something and they want to be a sculptor. And of course, that's, you know, such a common situation. I mean, are you unable to be happy if you're not aligned with what your purpose?
Well, you can have happiness anytime and sadness anytime. But if you want to have contentment and inner peace, you really hit the nail on the head there, Joseph, about expressing your true purpose, expressing your true desires, expressing your true self. And if you're not doing that, you will be miserable. You will not feel contentment. You will not feel inner peace. And you really got the nail on the head there with parents pushing their kids in certain directions that are not natural for the kids. It's really important that parents are cognizant of their children's unique aptitudes, their children's unique path and purpose for their life. It's very, very important.
What about a parent looking out for the future child, right? So, you know, we often defer happiness, and sometimes it's a wise decision, right? It's an investment. And then maybe a child wants to do one thing, but the parent says, look, you know, maybe this was what would make you happy today, but we have to look out for you in the future and what's going to make you happier. And it's a parent really making a decision for a child that this is going to make your future self happy. So today, instead of playing your guitar and practicing your guitar, you know, study your history book because it's going to get you into that college you need to get into, and you'll be better off in the future.
Well, sure. I mean, parents, their job also is to guide the child in the proper direction so that they finish their education, so that they do the things that are going to help them to become successful in life. Yes, definitely. That's also a part of finding inner peace and finding contentment, is to find a place in the world and in society where you can have contentment and inner peace in whatever situation you're in.
Can this inner peace be taught, or is it a solo journey?
Actually, it can be taught. That's what I teach, actually. I teach through meditation, teach people to become more peaceful and to experience contentment. Because the source of contentment is within you, your higher self, what I call your higher self, the part of yourself that is in tune with your true nature, that is your true nature, in fact.
And if I understand from your work, the ultimate goal is spiritual enlightenment. That's true happiness. That's true peace. That's what, in your words, that's to realize who we truly are, to realize the truth of our being, to live our true purpose and our true destiny.
Yes, I agree with that. However, to go out on a limb and say enlightenment might be a little far-fetched for people, and also, once again, too much pressure. It's like the word happiness.
Yeah, there's
enlightenment is like too much pressure.
Yeah.
But it is possible on a daily basis to experience inner peace and contentment through finding quiet time and going within, turning off your darn cell phones, you know. I'd love to throw them all away.
Yeah.
I'm talking about for kids especially, you know, go outside, play outside. Education is not valued the way it used to be, not funded the way it used to be. A lot of places have removed art, removed music, these kinds of curriculum from the public schools.
Now, your book, the book that I've read parts of, and I want to finish it because it really is a great book. It's Exploring Meditation, and it's a great entry-level book into meditation, but I think there's also probably valuable insights in there for experienced meditators. But can you tell us a little bit about your book, Exploring Meditation, where someone can begin with meditation? Because meditation is something that I do, you know, I hear it from a lot of different people that meditation, if not the key to happiness, the key to maybe some sort of peace. So I know Maharishi is he the founder of TM, Transcendental Meditation, or one of the pioneers?
Yes, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is not one of the pioneers. He is the founder, the founder of Transcendental Meditation.
And it's bigger now than ever, as it seems like everybody's TM all over the country, all over the world.
Well, I don't know if it's bigger than ever. I mean, when he was alive, there were 6 million people that were practicing transcendental meditation. I don't know if that's true anymore, but it is kind of having a comeback in the sense that the David Lynch Foundation is now promoting it. And as a result of that, a lot of celebrities are practicing TM and promoting TM. As a matter of fact, Katy Perry recently went to the Vatican to talk about TM at a conference at the Vatican.
Do you practice TM, or do you practice your own form of meditation?
I practice my own form of meditation, which is called divine revelation, and that's what I teach.
Now, is this something that can be taught? Is this something that can be taught in schools? Could you imagine or envision a school system embracing meditation, or is it already happening and I don't know about it?
Well, actually, there are a lot of school systems that are teaching transcendental meditation, the form of meditation that Maharishi founded. And there are other school systems that are teaching things called mindfulness.
Yeah, mindfulness is a big word, especially with, you know, being mindful of how we treat others, being mindful of, you know, focus in school, being mindful of where we're directing our attention. Where can someone start out? Someone who maybe they don't have your book, they're just listening to this. How can someone start to introduce meditation into their life?
It's really very simple. And I would say that anybody from age 12 upward, you could do a type of meditation that I'll just describe right now. And it's really very simple. You just close your eyes. You get comfortable. And comfort is the most important thing when it comes to meditation. People think you have to go into some pretzel pose, or you have to sit on the floor on a mat without back support and that sort of thing. It's actually very important to have back support and to be comfortable, sit in a comfortable chair, or even prop yourself up on your bed with pillows and be comfortable, number one. And then you just take some deep breaths, and I'll demonstrate a deep breath right now. It goes like this. That would be a deep breath.
Feels good.
So it's just really letting go, especially on the out breath, really letting go and giving up, relaxing. I love the word giving up, because what you're doing is you're just letting go of all the stress, all the things you've been worried about, all the things that you carry around with you, anxiety, fear, frustration, whatever it is, you're just letting it go with those out breaths. So you take a few deep breaths, and as you take deep breaths, just have the intention of going, getting quieter, getting still. You might even repeat some words to yourself like, peace, peace, be still and be at peace. And that will take you into quietude, into a state where you're feeling centered, you're feeling quiet, you're feeling peaceful, you're feeling content. And that's really how it's done. But the thing that I add that I think is very important in meditation is that when you're in that deep state, when you're in the state of quietude, that you do something that people usually generally don't do in deep meditation. And that is you ask for something. You ask a question, or you ask for inner peace, or you ask for an experience of expansion, or you ask for healing, or you ask for inner guidance. You ask something specific, and then you take another big deep breath, and then you do what I call the do nothing program. That means do nothing, nothing, and less than nothing, and then the answer will come to you. It will occur to you in your mind, or you'll have the experience that you asked for. So everything that I teach is based on one thing, and that is ask and it shall be given.
Would you recommend people, and I know, you know, people pray for all sorts of different things and they meditate on different things. Is this kind of like, you know, the book, The Secret also, where we're asking for not only those, you know, that the peace, the happiness, the ability to trust our intuition, are you also asking for any kind of material things in this, or is it not a place for the material requests?
That's a really good question that you just asked, Joseph, because there's two things, and they're separate from each other. One is meditation, and the other is prayer. So when you're in meditation, what you're doing is you're asking for certain experiences that you wish to have in meditation, and you can also ask for advice about certain things. You can ask for guidance and advice from your higher self or from the divine within, God within, whatever you want to call it. You're asking for advice and wisdom. And then prayer is a separate practice. That's something you do in at a different time. Prayer is where you're actually doing affirmations and stating the things that you want to accomplish in your life. And visualization could be part of that. And asking for those things to take place and to occur, and to doing specific methods of asking that are often called scientific prayer or affirmative prayer. So I've written books on both of these subjects. I've written books on meditation, which include Divine Revelation is one of my books, Awaken Your Divine Intuition, Exploring Meditation, which you mentioned. And I also wrote books on prayer, on manifesting, in other words, manifesting the things that you want.
I'm going to make sure we put links to your books on our show notes. Susan, Vern Trent is with us today. He's a school psychologist with 40-plus years of experience in the school setting. He's got a couple questions for you.
We're in Philadelphia, and the station that we're in is Praise 107.9. For those Philadelphia listeners, you said something that really struck a chord with me. And that is, peace be still. Those of the listeners in Philadelphia, I'm quite sure you're familiar with James Cleveland. And you have enlightened me, because when I was growing up, my grandmother used to always play that song, Peace Be Still by James Cleveland, whenever she was sad. And then she would say to me, now I have to take it to the altar. Well, this changed her whole demeanor, and in fact, it changed my demeanor. So one of the questions I have for you is, you mentioned religion briefly, and I don't want to go into too much detail, But in terms of happiness and sadness, I look at that as a dynamic and fluid continuum. Can you talk about life events and activities that would help individuals recognize when they are moving in that continuum from happiness to sadness, is in between, and the fluctuation?
Right. So we are living in a world of duality, black, white, male, female, yin, yang, happiness, sadness. That is the world that we're living in. And we have to recognize and accept the fact that we're going to have periods of happiness and periods of sadness. That's just part of life. You cannot escape happiness and sadness. You're not going to be sitting around with a happy grin on your face 24/7. You're happy. Even my guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was the happiest person I ever met, he was content. He had inner peace all the time, but he did experience emotions, happiness, sadness. He experienced all of life, and that's the way duality is. But there is something that is beyond duality. There is something beyond duality. That something that's beyond duality, whether you want to call it spirit, whether you want to call it God, whether you want to call it the absolute, whether you want to call it Sat, Chit, Ananda. There's so many words for that infinite presence, infinite power, but it is within us. We have within every individual. That is the center of our being. It is who we truly are. It is our own inner pool of sanctuary, of solace. And when we say peace, peace, be at peace, be still and be at peace, we're just affirming that we can experience that at any time in any challenging situation that comes to us, because we are going to have challenges in life. We cannot escape these ups and downs, but we can experience inner peace.
Do you study any of the Stoic philosophies where it's, you know, just the trick is never get too happy, never get too sad, just try to stay even keeled? Or is it okay to really feel happiness, or with the highs, are there necessarily lows?
Okay, what you've just described of trying to remain inner, you know, kind of even keeled, that sounds like mood making to me. It doesn't sound like it's something that people can actually successfully do unless they are experiencing higher consciousness. You can't just pretend to be even keeled. You have to actually be even keeled. And the only way to be even keeled is to experience your true divine nature, your true nature of being.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us. I feel like we could talk for a lot longer. Maybe you'll join us again one day. That would be great.
Sure, I'd love to.
Yeah. If I could just close out real quick, I want to ask you, what would you say to someone who just kind of writes off meditation? Maybe they're just kind of old school and they're like, you know, it's just a waste of time. It's not going to do any good. I don't have time for it. You know, quickly, what can you tell someone who takes that approach to meditation?
I think that a lot of people just think they can't do it, or it's hard. They think that they have to focus. They think that they have to concentrate. They have to have an unwavering mind, or that they have to block out thoughts. None of those is true. You can't block out thoughts. You can't have an unwavering mind. We have a wavering mind. We have thoughts coming and going. Meditation is not a way to block out thoughts, and you don't have to focus and exert to have a successful meditation. Meditation is about relaxing, letting go. And it's really easy to do.
Thank you so much, Susan. We're going to take a short break now. If anyone wants to call in and ask any questions or tell us what happiness means to you, 215-263-1079. 215-263-1079. We'll be right back.
Do you own a Bentley? The Bentley Robe Company is the oldest black-owned operated manufacturer of custom clergy, choir, graduation, and judicial attire in Philadelphia. Bentley Robe Company uses the finest quality fabrics. Founded by Reverend Dr. Wilm Bentley, the family stays true to his vision of providing distinctive garments to clients worldwide. You can own a Bentley too. Let us design something for your pastor and choir. Give us a call at 215-817-7212 or visit us online at BentleyRobeCo.com.
Are you sick of your child having bad days in school? Is your child being bullied at school? Visit educationlawyers.com or call 833-YOU-CAN-SUE and connect with an attorney from Montgomery Law. Does your child need an IEP or have an IEP that isn't being followed? Visit educationlawyers.com or call 833-YOU-CAN-SUE and connect with an attorney from Montgomery Law. That's 833, the letter U, CAN-SUE, Montgomery Law, teaching schools a lesson.
Hold up. EducationLawyers.com? There are lawyers that sue schools? Apparently. 833, you can sue. How did I not know about Montgomery Law? My child's charter school told me to either withdraw her or she was getting expelled. That's crazy. My child has an IEP that has not been followed all year. We need to visit EducationLawyers.com. I don't have time to visit a website. I'm calling Montgomery Law now. What was that number? 833, the letter U, can sue. Montgomery Law, teaching schools a lesson.
Keeping your child healthy includes taking care of their teeth. Following these steps can set your child on the right path. Starting at birth, clean your baby's gums with water and a soft cloth. Once their teeth appear, brush with fluoridated toothpaste twice a day. Never put a baby to bed with a bottle of milk, formula, or juice. Those drinks can cause cavities. Check with your pediatrician and dentist for more tips and support. For more information, visit endcavities.org. This has been a message from the Children's Dental Health Project, United Healthcare, in this station.
All right, we are back with Lisa Sansom. Lisa Sansom is the owner of LVS Consulting. It's a boutique consulting firm that helps build positive organizations with the use of positive psychology tools and techniques. Lisa Sansom works with clients in education, from preschool through higher education, and also many corporate and not-for-profit clients. Lisa completed her Master's of Applied Positive Psychology right here in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Great to hear from you. Thanks so much.
All right, so let's just start with, what is positive psychology?
Positive psychology is a field of research that takes a look at what is working well with people. So psychology as usual, since about World War II, has been looking at mental illnesses and personality disorders, and that's a really important field of research. We know that about 1 in 4 adults will suffer from a mental illness of some sort in their lives. And when I say suffer from, I mean...
1 in 4, did you say? 25%?
About 1 in 4.
Wow, unbelievable.
Yeah. To the extent that it's going to be disruptive in some way to their normal functioning. And so that's really important that we have that field of research. But when we flip that statistic, it means that about 3 in 4 of us are not dealing with that. And positive psychology really looks at what is working well with those people, how can we help those people do better? And there's a lot that scientists are discovering that actually applies to that other 1 in 4 as well, so that we can raise the well-being and flourishing and thriving of everybody in across the globe, really.
So, correct. So, instead of focusing on why are 20 and the you know, and just how I reacted, like, wow, 25%, instead of focusing on that somewhat staggering number, let's look at the bigger number, 75%. Wow, how are 75% of the people figuring it out? Let's focus on those 75% and take the tips and tricks and tools from them and apply it to everybody.
Yeah. And back when this field started about 20 years ago, somebody did research and found that about 90% of published peer-reviewed psychology papers were about negative things. They were about personality disorders and mental illnesses and all kind of the bad things about the human condition. And so positive psychology says, hey, can we equalize that, please? Can we also learn about great loving relationships and how to have more of that? Can we learn about positive emotions like happiness and how to have more of that? Can we learn about meaning and purpose in life and the people who are doing really well at living and finding and creating their meaning and purpose in life, and how can we have more of that?
It sounds like happiness, right, and how you brought it up is kind of in the middle of those two, right? So it's the relationships, and then it's the meaningful purpose from, you know, what I've gathered in my research and just from living life, and happiness is kind of in the middle of that. Or am I wrong? To you, what is happiness?
For me, happiness is, it's kind of the answer to the question. When you ask a lot of people, what do you want in life? And they say, well, you know, I want money, I want a new car, I want a bigger house, I want to be married, whatever. And then you ask why, and you kind of dig. And bottom line is, people believe that's going to bring them happiness. It is a positive emotional state that people want to be in and that people want to experience.
Why are so many people focused on happiness now? Is it now more than ever? Has it always been? I'm thinking, you know, I'm 35 or so years old, and I think about when I was a kid. I mean, I don't know that there was, and maybe I was just oblivious to it, but I don't know that there was the same focus on happiness. Where now, if there are bookstores, if you walk into a bookstore, it's going to be, you know, the first table when you walk in on happiness, and every book, you know, half the books on the New York Times, it's kind of like just throw happiness in the title of your book and you're going to sell your book. Just like if a company puts, Bitcoin in their latest endeavors, people are going to buy their stock. Why is happiness helping everyone's stock?
I think that's a really great question. I agree with you. You put happiness in the title of a book and it sells. I mean, just look at, you know, any book that's listed in the top Amazon in psychology and self-help. Probably happiness is there. It's a feel-good emotion, and it's also, like your previous speaker was saying, it's the quick hit. You know, you can be happy when you eat ice cream. You can be happy when you buy yourself something new. You can be happy when you get together with friends, and it feels good. And these days, there's a lot of icky feelings going on, and we are aware of the world state in ways that we were not before with social media. And, you know, you can broadcast news widely across the globe instantaneously, and people just want a nice place to go to and a nice feeling every now and then. And so I think that's the happiness. And I also agree, it's not sustainable. We are human beings, and we get to experience the entire range of human emotions. And we're maybe more aware of that than we ever were before. And so happiness is one little piece that maybe pulls us out of that darkness occasionally.
And about, you know, our access to social media, our access to 24/7 news cycles. Maybe in the past, the children's exposure to what's going on in the world would be limited to, you know, watching their parents watch the news, and then they're kind of getting it secondhand. But now it's just thrown into kids' feeds. So about children, what do we know about children and happiness right now?
We know that children tend to be happier, more joyful, more zestful than adults. It's kind of a natural state for them to be in. We also know that happiness is good for learning. So we're talking about schools. When people are in a positive emotional state, they tend to be more creative and innovative. They tend to be more open to new ideas because you're in a safe place. When you're happy, you're feeling good, you tend to make better connections with your brain between old material and new material. So happiness and generally positive emotional states like curiosity, like joy, like contentment, like being calm and peaceful, those are all positive. Those are really good for kids and really good for learning.
And I mean, this is stuff we know from, you know, from a corporate perspective, because I think corporations are realizing that, like, happy employees are productive employees. So companies are hiring consultants like you to help build positive working environments, you know, hopefully because they care about their employees, but also because I think they know that happy employees are productive employees. And I guess the same works with students, right? Happy students are productive students.
Happy students are productive students, and happy students are also learning students. And really, the goal of education is we want to prepare students for the work life. We want to prepare them to be positive, productive members of society and to get good jobs and to contribute to society in a meaningful, important, pro-social way. And so, yeah, positive emotions, engagement, you know, there, it's all part of that.
So that's what we're teaching, right? So we're focusing on, at the least, school should be teaching how to be, how to get a job, how to maintain a job, how to learn the skills that you would need for a job, or really just to learn how to learn, right? So they're teaching you how to learn so that if there's some new task that you're faced with, that you'll be able to figure it out, to learn it. But are we teaching happiness in schools? Should we be teaching happiness in schools? And if so, are we?
I'm going to go up a step on that. And I'm going to say that the entire school environment should be one that is conducive to learning. So if a teacher takes their class and teaches them about things that will make them happier, that's kind of a baby step in the right direction. But you also want to be in a school community that cares. You want to have teachers that recognize the strengths and what's going well for students. You want to have a safe school community, just at a very basic line. If all you're doing is teaching that in the classroom, those kids may not be able to take it somewhere else because maybe there are other teachers who don't care. Those kids feel like they don't belong, and belonging and mattering are really, really important for kids and for school communities. We want to make sure that they're taking this home as well. Some of the best schools that are practicing this involve the parents as well, and they're taking this home to the parents. They're either teaching the parents directly, or they're having the students do activities that involve going home and also sharing this with the family. You know, we've heard the expression, it takes a village to raise a child. We want a whole community out there that is helping these kids be the best people that they can be. And so teaching happiness, yeah, sure, that's a very tiny part of it. I think there's a much bigger picture when we look at the whole school and the whole environment, too.
Susan, hi, this is Vern Trent, and I'm really glad to hear what you just said, because my former office in the school district was the Office of School Climate and Safety. Mm-hmm. And everything you mentioned is what we attempted to do, particularly in terms of teaching pro-social skills, ensuring that the students were safe and felt safe and secure in the schools. The problem we had is we attempted to implement evidence-based and research-based programs. Many people did not understand that and wanted to focus purely on academics. And our position was you can't have true learning and high expectations and great academics if you don't have a positive school climate. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Vern, I think you and I have a lot to discuss after this show is over, because I agree with you 100%, and I would love to continue that conversation. Our brains, and I'm going a little bit beyond positive psychology here, our brains do best when we are in a safe, welcoming environment. And I agree with you, there has been this shift to focus on just academics. And I think Susan earlier had mentioned that a lot of schools are getting rid of things like recess, physical education, arts, music. And if we really want to create positive, constructive kids who are part of a flourishing society, they need all of that. Our brains thrive with safety, with belonging, with mattering, with stories, with creativity. And math and sciences are also very, very important, but we're going to be better at learning those more core STEM courses that there's a lot of focus on these days when we have all that nourishment for our brain and all those different dimensions as well. And so I love that you were working to create this positive environment in your school, because we don't exist just sitting in a desk in the classroom. We exist in all of society. And I love that you were working to bring in evidence-based interventions, I'll call them.
Right.
Because we know that those are more likely to work.
And Lisa, one final thing. We were actually able to create a position titled Climate Managers. And it was the role of those individuals to address all of these things. And we wanted to roll it out systemically. And of course, budgetary obstacles always get in the way. But if a school had a climate manager, that was his or her job to work on all of those non-instructional and a lot of people say, oh, those fuzzy good things. Well, those fuzzy good things helped students and parents, and ergo the entire school community and extended into the community outside of the school. So if you're ever in Philadelphia, check out some of the schools that have climate managers. I'm not sure exactly what they are doing now, but I know what they did under my watch.
I love the idea of a climate manager, and you probably know this, climate belongs to everybody. I used to teach high school myself, and when a new principal came into our school, that climate changed. And
exactly.
When new heads of department came in, that climate changed. And even a new front desk secretary or receptionist could change the climate. So, yeah, that belongs to everybody.
Lisa, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we can bring you back again. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next we're going to speak with Milana Perepi-Olkina. Milana is a best-selling author and spiritual guide. She's a self-proclaimed gypsy. She grew up in the former Soviet Union. At times, her gypsy spirit, as you might imagine, clashed with communist ideals. Nonetheless, Milana held on to her Romani ancestry and uses her wisdom to help people heal, transcend their troubles, and generally to live a happy and more fulfilled life. Milana, are you with us? Hey, and Milana, if you can today, I really want you to speak to just that, what it's like, you know, because I think a lot of children face that. Maybe it's not such extremes that they have this gypsy spirit in them and they're, you know, surrounded by a gypsy family living in the former Soviet Union. But I think people do have these dualities that they face. So what can you tell us about your own experience, and what advice can you give to parents or children that might be fighting these two sides?
The most important thing to know is that we, all of us, have resilience. When I was growing up, my day was not about learning and playing. My day was about surviving. Because we had so little, we had to survive. We didn't have food on the plate. We didn't have heating during cold winters. There were so many things that were lacking that were difficult, yet they taught me how to be resilient. And they also taught me the importance of distinction between modern culture and ancient culture. If you look at our modern culture and you see, oh, we have science, we have technology, we use logic, we know things, that's not necessarily better. If you look at the ancient cultures, you will notice that people used to be happier. And I'm talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And gypsies came from India, moved to Europe about 1,000 years ago, and kept that very unusual culture that keeps things in the old ways. So what do I mean? In the modern culture, how do kids learn? In schools, so learning is auditory. Kids sit at a table and listen. In the ancient cultures, all of the learning was visual. Kids would observe someone doing something, and that's how they would learn. In the modern culture, we see up close. We look at the phone, at the book, at the computer. In the ancient culture, we would be seeing in the distance. We would look at the clouds. We would go to a forest and look beyond the trees. We would look up on the hill. What is there? In the modern culture, we pay attention to detail. In the ancient culture, we look at the whole picture. Do you see? We use a part of our brain that is very, very different from the part of our brain that ancients used.
I mean, that's the part of our brain that maybe we're drawn to use, right? So that's the part of our brain that evolutionary we should be using, but in order to conform to our modern technological society, that part of the brain is being pushed to the side?
We use the logical part of our brain too much. Too much. You probably heard left brain, right brain. That's not necessarily correct. I will use the term logic and magic. So when you use logical part of your brain, you're rational, analytical, you are thinking in categories, you plan, you have structure, discipline, and it's all necessary. It's overused. If you go into the magical part of the brain, you are spontaneous, intuitive, psychic. You see, there's a very,
can this be
very,
taught,
very
or is it something
field.
You have to be born with? I mean, do you have to be born with those intuitions, or is this something that can be taught to a child in, you know, somewhere in America who was born with every privilege in the world and never faced any adversity? Can this be taught?
We are all born with both parts of our brain not developed. So if you go to school and you sit at a desk and you use directions, you use exercises, drills, you're reading, you're writing, you're using math, computers, and logic, you're goal-oriented, your teacher says, if X, then Y. You're time-oriented, your classes are from this time until that time, and you repeat it year after year after year, you will develop this part of the brain responsible for logic.
And then with that, do we lose our spirit? Are we beating this spirit out of kids?
Yes.
And then how
yes.
do we get that spirit back? So how does someone who's all of a sudden they finish, you know, so many years of school, maybe medical school or law school or some other kind of graduate school that takes forever in their mid-20s and they feel like, oh my goodness, like how did this happen? Like my spirit is gone. How do we get it back?
Very easy. You do things that feed the part of the brain responsible for magic. What are those? Dance. Dance with music using large movements. Walking in nature, singing, humming, using nonverbal communication.
So basically being a kid again, do the things
exactly.
that we observe a three-year-old doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Being a six-year-old kid again, reading fairy tales, writing poetry, playing games, becoming creative, using your imagination, you are paying attention to your gut feeling, being trusting. Being flexible, and also if you're spending more of the time in cities and houses and cars, you go outside and play with animals. You pick up a leaf. You look at clouds. You search for ants. You search for rainbows. Instead of thinking, I, what's good for me, you think, what is good for the community? Instead of planning everything to death, you start dreaming. Instead of having a routine, I will do this, I will have a list, 1, 2, 3, 4, check, cross, you will start creating surprises.
So,
all of these things,
Milana,
will wake up.
It's true. It's true. And we need to wake that spirit back up. And I love that advice. And I hear that from other people as well. Just recently, I had a long discussion with a holistic lifestyle guru from India, Dr. Mickey Mehta. And he spoke about all those same things. Just get out of the concrete jungle, as he called it. Go to nature, be with nature, look around. But he actually had a point similar to the point you made earlier about, again, growing up in the former Soviet Union, not having many of the necessities that we have in life now, many of the comforts, heat, air conditioning, sometimes not even having food, but, you know, seeing kids still, despite all this, being happy. And he made the point, you know, he'll see in the slums of Mumbai, you know, kids who have absolutely nothing, just with the biggest smiles on their faces, playing in the mud with a soccer ball that, you know, the whole town shares, a single soccer ball. So how can we explain that? How are these children so happy when, you know, your typical child in America who might have everything that they could ever want doesn't get a certain toy at Target when they're out with their parent and throws a tantrum as if they just got their leg cut off?
Because one of the biggest keys to happiness is gratitude. The kids who have everything and anything, when they snap their fingers and they get a toy, when they have any meal with a cake after dinner each time they eat, do not have gratitude. They do not know what it's like to value things. Imagine a kid who has 100 toys, doesn't know where they are. They can be in the closet, in the boxes, may play with one toy, with another, but doesn't value the toys. Now, imagine me, who had just one doll the entire childhood. That doll had a name. That doll got hair wash each day. Do you understand the difference? I valued that doll so much. I was so grateful for having that doll. I experienced joy each time I ran home to pick my doll and look, okay, maybe I can find a new outfit. It's a completely different feeling.
Tell me this, even though that doll meant everything to you, if you can, and you know, you can be honest, looking back, if you had to share that doll with a friend, would you be able to share that doll? Because I know sharing is also a problem. Kids who have everything, they can't share one of their things. What, you had that one doll, would you be willing to share that doll?
Well, we would play together, and we would share things. And believe it or not, I still have that doll after years and years and years. And same with food. If you have anything and everything, you just eat it, you forget it, you chew it, swallow it, run away.
It's true.
But if you have one meal a day and it's a soup made out of bones and some potatoes, you will swallow every spoon with joy.
And savor every bite. Milana, thank you so much. We have to move on right now. I thank you very much for joining us today. We're very appreciative, okay? Okay. Next and finally, we have Pamela Johnson with us. Pamela founded the Secret Society of Happy People in 1998. So for the past 20 years, she's dedicated her life to unlocking the secret of happiness. And she's going to close us out by telling us what is the secret of happiness. Pamela Johnson, hi.
You set the bar high. Good morning.
That's it. Just the secret for happiness. Nothing else. Thank you.
After 20 years of doing this, I like to kind of boil it down to what I call practical happiness principles, and there's five of them, but I think it's about how do we realistically discover happiness in our, you know, in our lives, whether we're at work, whether we're at school, whether, you know, we're at home. What is this realistic balance, you know, with happiness? So, you know, probably since I know probably one of the easiest ways to do it is we identified 31 types of happiness, and I've heard a lot of your earlier guests speak about them. You know, expanding our definition of happiness helps us find more of it.
Okay, so what's your definition of happiness? How do we define happiness?
I think happiness is just a feeling that happens in the moment. So I think we can, you know, you can have a moment, for example, everyone says, you know, we should always look for gratitude, but I think you can be having a moment that you're happy, but maybe you're not feeling so grateful because you've got a bunch of chaos going on, so you're just a little frustrated with that continuum. But you might can go find an amused moment that somewhat balances out the chaos, and then you can start kind of climbing the happiness ladder, so to speak. You can find some other types of happiness. So I think it's very momentary. I think there's, like I said, there's different types of happiness. There's that contentment is a type of happiness. You know, and some days that may be where it sits. We may not ever reach that state of enthusiasm or, like, you know, kind of like doing a cartwheel type happiness, but we're content, and that's a great, you know, a great type of happiness.
Pamela, do you feel that people can learn to choose happiness? I had a staff member who was always happy, and people resented her for that. However, when I talked to her, she said, I choose to be happy. So do you feel people can learn to choose happiness when there's no negative major life event that's pushing them in the other direction?
Well, a study out of Stanford years ago showed that about 50% of our happiness is what we choose. So our mind kind of decides about 50% of our happiness, and then about 50% of our happiness could be sort of connected to our genetics. So somebody who, you know, you meet these people that are just over the top happy sometimes, they may have this combo of choosing to be happy, and they may have a high genetic happiness, you know, tracker, so to speak.
In addition to choosing,
where they're just naturally happier than some people. But half of our happiness is definitely what we choose to look at.
Pamela, in addition to, you know, another way to say choosing to be happy, and I know this is in your work, it's admitting to be happy, right? So I know that you're behind what's called the Happiness Happens Month, and it started as the Admit Your Happy Day. And tell me if I'm taking the Admit Your Happy Day out of context, but is it kind of like saying, like, yeah, you know, I am happy, and why is it sometimes hard to admit that you're happy? There's almost like a stigma attached to it.
When the society
started 20 years ago, we were really at the height of what we kind of call the Jerry Springer era of TV. And so, as you said, now you walk into a bookstore and a table will have, you know, tons of books with the word happy in them. 20 years ago, you walk, and this is before, this is kind of when the positive psychology movement, the initial research started coming out. But prior to that, you'd walk into the bookstore and there would be a ton of books about sort of the negative elements of you know, adult children of alcoholics, or, you know, just some of the problems that people, you know, grew up with. And that would sort of be the titles of the books and what we were focused on. We were a little bit more focused on the what's wrongs, again, prior to the positive psychology research. So at that particular point, if you were happy, like your staff member said, some people don't like it when you're so happy. People who were happy kind of felt like they didn't have a place to kind of express it. And that was sort of the whole reason for the Secret Society of Happy People. So we started asking that question, are you happier than you admit you are? Are you happier than what you're talking about? It's I'm not asking you to be happier than you are, but are you really taking a realistic inventory of your happiness? And hopefully, you know, probably half your life is happy. You know, if it's not, you probably need to.
Is that what,
you know,
is 50% the goal? Is that what we're, is that if we're happy half the time? I had a friend who said that in a relationship. He's like, I don't have to love her all the time. As long as 51% of the time, if I can stand her, then it's good enough, because the other half I'm asleep is fine. So what is that?
I think it's different for everyone, so I wouldn't want to assign that for somebody. I hope everybody can at least, you know, half happy with their life. You know, I would say I'm probably more than half happy with my life, but I think, you know, so I think, again, your aspirational goal is different for everybody. But let's say maybe you come from a place where you were happy with maybe 10% of your life. Getting to 50% would be great, right?
No, that's true. That's true. Pamela, I'm going to have links to your site in the show notes, but everyone, SOHP.com. You can find more about the Secret Society of Happy People, and you can find more out about Pamela Gail Johnson. Thank you so much for joining me today on the EducationLawyers.com Sunday School Show. Thank you, Vern, for being here. I hope everybody has a happy Sunday.